So am I still waiting? Waiting a long time.
Waiting for tonight.
Listen to review,
right now, right? That's what you say. We get it by now.
I gotta ask, do you regret leaving the independent scene where you were a big fish in a small pond to ultimately drown in the sea that is the WWE?
Well, that's funny because Daniel Bryan never wrestled on the independent scene. I don't know, if you go on YouTube, Daniel Bryan, all you ever see is Daniel Bryan in the WWE. But there was this guy, man, he was out there, he was kicking people's heads in. People called him the best wrestler in the world, the best technical wrestler in the world. He was a champion of Japan and Mexico and Europe. And do you know what his name was? It was, you might know this guy.
What's next for this guy?
For Daniel Bryan, I don't know, man. That might be the end of him. I mean, he's eliminated from NXT. I mean, he can't even beat rookies. What's wrong with this guy? He can take Batista to the limit, but he can't beat rookies. Daniel Bryan might be done, but Bryan Danielson, God knows what's going to happen to him.
Bry, best of luck in your future endeavors. I know you're going to be just fine.
Going
he has the arm. But it's a counter mutilation. Here it is.
He can flip over
there it is.
That bridge.
And there's got the bridge.
It. Danielson comes up the winner.
I told you.
Pinfall.
I told you.
Damn it. I'll prove to everybody that I have more heart than anybody else in this sport.
Hello and welcome to Review Away. I'm John Pollock with Wei Ting.
A lot of buzz about this show.
Tons of buzz in the air.
Yeah.
Mr. Ting, I can't help but ignore the wonderful scent that is coming from your coffee mug. This is a vanilla flavored coffee that you are taking in.
It is a French vanilla.
A French vanilla.
Which I did not buy from any cafe. But it was made from the office coffee machine.
Oh man, those office coffees get a bad rap, but
they're great.
They're efficient. They're free.
Yeah, they're free. That is the primary, yeah. And they're convenient. And they do the job. I'm not nearly enough of a connoisseur of coffee to be able to tell the difference.
I'm not even giving a shout out to what I'm drinking. They will no longer get any love after the controversy uncovered last week.
The former hockey player, branded coffee company,
yeah,
shall not be named.
Yeah, we'll call it
him,
Lanny McDonald.
Lanny McDonald's?
Doug Gilmore's.
McDonald's is a bad, probably.
Yeah, I know. One. That name gets enough.
Doug Gilmore's?
Doug Gilmore's.
Doesn't sound as tasty. I don't know. I don't know if I'd eat at Gilmore's.
We're going for our coffee at Doug's.
Dougie's.
Yes. A Doug bit. I want to have a Doug bit.
How about Wendell Clark's?
Wendell Clark has a restaurant, actually, town.
How about Dave Andrechuk's?
Dave was Andrechuk was the other name I was actually just thinking about. The awkward skater. That was actually very good.
Andrechuk makes it sound like you're going to puke. What about the Andrechuk?
We're going to Andrechuk's. No, not again. Well,
you've always got time for Dave Andrechuk's. No, it doesn't really work.
Well, that's nonetheless funny. Wei, how are you? Is everything good?
Excellent, man.
There's a lot going on in the world.
These Wednesdays. Yeah, there's a ton going on.
Wait, what would you do if you woke up one morning and waiting.com had been purchased by your political adversary and you were running for president?
Well, waiting.com has been purchased.
Oh, has it? I bet that is probably one that is not easy to get. What is waiting.com? It's a pretty shitty website. This is like a GeoCities site, man.
Page dedicated to you who
brain
are
injury help. Brain Anatomy and Hope After.
It's a page dedicated to you who are waiting while someone is in a coma due to brain injury. Wow. That's not very pleasant. But.
Okay, they have this exchange here. You have a phone call from the hospital, he adds. Everything turns flat and dull. I pick up the phone and a voice tells me my husband has been in an accident. Everything takes on an air of unreality. I am so trapped in that moment that I can scarcely breathe. And then you could click to go to the next page. This is a dark, dark sight, Wei. This is waiting.com. And then we go to all of our brain injury assistance. We are here. Who we are. The bridge. And then you can learn more about legal issues, about brain injury, and an ICU guide. This is one of the worst put together websites. This had to have been made in the late 90s.
Hmm. But a far better cause than anything I'd be able to provide to the world.
The attorney is Gordon S. Johnson Jr.
Oh, weird. It's like a...
On waiting.com.
Amalgamation of everything that I know. Except the brain injury part. I hope to never know that. What about johnpollock.com?
Well, I'll tell you, johnpollock.com, it was these parents that had bought it and just put up a picture of their kid, the last I had checked. Unless it's gone. Maybe it's open.
Maybe it's available. Maybe you should get it right now before we release this podcast and some jerk
decides to
buy it.
Yeah, like Donald Trump will scoop it up. But back to my original point.
Okay.
Donald Trump scoops up jebbush.com as it becomes available on Tuesday morning.
Love it.
I mean, you may hate Donald Trump. But that was a coy move.
It's so petty. And I think it's a move that is so fitting of his character. This is a guy who personally doesn't feel like much of a serious candidate for president. But nonetheless, the fact that he is and is still able to kind of get away with all these troll-like actions in the public is very surprising to me. But I think we're in store for, or we have been in store for a very entertaining political race. So he stole the dude's URL?
He did. And I'm trying to find the tweet because he had tweeted it out, but,
can you type in jebbush.com?
Well, right here now? We go. Here is, nothing has come up for my website, but we go to jebbush.com. And, by the time people are listening to this, maybe Jeb will have secured this URL back. I wonder if you, as an individual, especially a public figure like Jeb Bush, do you have a certain right to your own URL? Would he have a case he could make that
I don't think so.
It still goes to, it redirects to DonaldTrump.com.
Someone
slipped up big by losing this address.
I don't
on
know.
Team I, Bush or yeah. Team, Team Trump on the ball here.
Yeah, I don't know what the grounds are for that. You know, whether or not if you're, let's say you're Barack Obama. Do you have a right to own BarackObama.com? Or would you have to buy it out?
It's a good question.
Let's type in BarackObama.com. This whole episode should just be us
web surfing.
Discovering the internet for the first time. I mean, I would assume that one would go right to the president.
Barack?
Oh, God, the internet sucks here.
Yeah,
doesn't it?
It really does. BarackObama.com belongs to him. Organizing for action. We're the people who don't just support progressive change. We're fighting for it.
I imagine he has a lot of money, enough money to buy out whoever owned that website previously. But do you think Jeb Bush is offering Donald Trump a sum right now?
Probably a hefty amount. Much like when Chael Sonnen got the rights to Red Panty Night and offered Conor McGregor a 24-hour window to buy it back, or else it would be lost forever.
I hate that.
I mean, people are ruthless out there, Mr. Ting. Have you taken a look at the new WWE Network programming lineup, which might have an impact on this very show?
Why is that?
Well, this is stuff that's all possible future review material.
I have. Yeah.
We have the Edge and Christian show that's debuting this Sunday immediately after Fastlane, which I will watch. I will watch this.
I will watch and
I will give it at least 1 week of an opportunity.
Yep. And we'll talk about it on one of our shows, I'm sure.
Yes. You can review Total Divas and maybe we can squeeze in a mini review of Edge and Christian's show that totally reeks of awesomeness.
Are you interested? Has your interest level raised since you first saw this trailer?
I feel the trailer actually did nothing for me. In fact, it was more of a turnoff.
Yeah.
But I do feel that it wasn't. I feel if I watch this show, I will at least find it humorous, providing it's no longer than 20 to 22 minutes.
Yeah.
Like this show is an hour would be not good.
Mm-hmm.
But I feel that these two, as I mentioned before, these are two former wrestlers that are wrestling geeks.
Yep.
And they are appealing to wrestling fans that will get every inside joke.
Who are much of the network subscribers.
Yes. Face. This network is totally being targeted at the diehard wrestling fan, which is amazing when you go back to the infancy of this network before it launched. And there was discussion of how much wrestling will we put on this? Will we put non-wrestling programming on this?
Yeah.
And now we are in an age way where they have signed some of the top independent talent to facilitate NXT, and where they've now announced this global cruiserweight series that's going to premiere July 13th, which will be Wednesday nights immediately after NXT. Like, this will be your diehard wrestling fans 2-hour orgasm.
Oh, yeah.
Which, it's just like this 2-hour block that everyone is going to be checking out, and it's going to feature 32 cruiserweights from around the world coming to Full Sail University.
Okay, I'm going to ask you about who you think will be featured on the show, but who do you think will be calling it? If you had your pick.
Well, it would certainly be Mauro Ranallo calling this. And I couldn't imagine Michael Cole calling this for the audience that you're specifically targeting.
Yeah.
I would definitely go with Mauro. As a color commentator, I could see this being Corey Graves getting that opportunity where the two can work together. I think that's a possibility.
Mm. Yeah.
Who would you like to see?
I think the same. Yeah, very much.
I think no one other than Mauro could call this in WWE.
I could see them getting, you know what? Rich Brennan, you know.
Tom Phillips, I think they would maybe lean on. It would be possible. But I feel that Mauro Ranallo, this makes all the sense in the world that you would have this guy calling this.
Depending on how they decide to tape these.
Yes.
Do you know anything about this right now? Do you any word on what names might be involved?
I don't know specific names. I mean, I've heard some stuff bandied about. I've known about this show for some time. I mean, this wasn't the biggest secret that they were developing this cruiserweight series. Mm-hmm. What incarnation it was going to be, I didn't know all the specifics. But in terms of names that are out there, I mean, they certainly have their ability. A, it's WWE, and that becomes very attractive for anyone out there that is not contractually bound. So, I mean, that automatically disqualifies anyone with ROH. Very unlikely, I think, that you're going to see anyone that's attached to New Japan that would be a part of this. So you're going to be looking at unsigned talent. And I feel
a lot of Evolve talent.
Evolve, certainly. Certainly Evolve. As well, I think that our fans in the UK will probably, this will be a great outlet for people that are in Progress or Rev Pro, places like that, that I think would have the opportunity to come over here.
Interesting. Do you think that this will work with this audience, and how do they avoid the stigma that has typically been attached to, you know, labeling somebody as a cruiserweight, or, you know, what they tried with the Super Astro show in the 90s.
Yeah, I mean, great points. I mean, Super Astros was a disaster. I think that the fact that this is happening on the WWE network, I feel it's really a different product when you're looking at this. This is much more of an NXT style of thinking.
Do you think the label of cruiserweight hurts it when they could just be calling this, you know, fast wrestling?
Light heavyweights. Because they'll all be 205 pounds or under, according to this description.
But my point is the cruiserweight label at this point sort of a dirty word now?
No, because I feel that this is very self-contained, and it's to an audience that does not look at that as a negative label. I think the audience that will be watching this is consuming this much like they do the Best of the Super Juniors, and doesn't look at the word junior, which on a surface level, what sounds more beneath someone? Junior heavyweight?
Yeah.
Or cruiserweight?
Yeah.
I mean, that was the whole reason they adopted the term cruiserweight in WCW, was that it didn't sound as if it was less than.
Like even light heavyweight would.
Yes.
Yeah.
So I don't feel that that's going to be a big negative. And I feel that anyone that is a big standout in this, they're going to be going to NXT, where I don't think they will be identified as, quote unquote, a cruiserweight.
They will. So this is the show to try to get an NXT contract.
It might be.
So that they can somehow make it to the main roster.
This is another pipeline for them.
Interesting.
Are you interested in this?
Of course.
Are you looking forward to this?
Absolutely.
You seem very skeptical about its possibilities.
I'm just skeptical of, I feel like NXT itself is, you can argue with, is a cruiserweight show.
Yep.
I mean, look at who the top talent are on that show. And I'm just wondering if calling this a cruiserweight, whatever they call it, cruiserweight series,
you could have just called this the global series.
Sure. Yeah. I'm just wondering if the cruiserweight label is the best way to promote some of these guys who I'm sure will have success on the NXT roster. And then perhaps afterwards on the main roster, do you want to label some of these talents as cruiserweights when, you know, AJ Styles, you don't think of as a cruiserweight. Finn Balor, you don't think of as a cruiserweight.
They could have called this the Global Force Wrestling Series.
Oh.
Getting dangerously close to Jeff Jarrett territory with this title, the Global Cruiserweight Series. That's the one that's going to stand out to most people amongst the lineup of programming coming your way. But that's not until July 13th. Also, Camp WWE will premiere Monday, May the 2nd. I'm actually looking.
What is that? The cartoon?
It's the Seth Green Studios that has put this together, and it's the talent that are supplying voices where Vince McMahon is the head camp counselor.
Is it claymation or is it like it's not
No, it's not claymation.
Okay, it's actually like animated.
I believe so.
Okay,
yes.
That sounds.
This was the one that had to be significantly redone because Hulk Hogan was going to be a character on.
I see. I'm very curious to know the tone of that cartoon because if it's Seth Green producing it, there's this little thing that aired online that never saw the light of day again. I don't even know where you could find it, but it was like a robot chicken type of thing.
Yes.
Produced by the WWE, featuring just all these little inside smart marky jokes. And that is exactly the type of tone that I hope that this show is able to hit on. If you watch, do you watch Robot Chicken?
No.
They have some tremendous, Star Wars specials and like DC Comics specials where they will just poke fun at kind of the nerdiest details of like a big running gag, on the Star Wars specials is like, they'll do like a thing where like Boba Fett, this will mean nothing to you, John, but Boba Fett dies. ended up never dying in Return of the Jedi, and instead you kind of see how the rest of his days are inside the stomach of the giant snake monster that ends up swallowing him.
Yes.
As John is checking his phone completely.
I'm sorry.
Not paying attention to what I'm saying. But the potential is there for them to do something totally catered towards this demographic that we've been talking about.
Also, are you interested in Camp WWE? I'm at least curious, very much like you're saying about what the tone is, because this could be very funny.
It could be a kids show, though. I mean, I know that they're in that market as well. But either way, I check out the first episode.
And also, back by unpopular demand, it is season 2 of Swerved. It's back way.
Some people are demanding it. I'm sure. We're not the only people watching this network.
No, but I've heard nothing about Swerve, to be quite honest with you.
Well, again, you're only hearing from probably people who listen to this podcast, but what about your typical, you know...
Well, that's it, Wei.
Wrestling fan out there.
Are there typical... Because to me, it's...
Oh, come on.
I had to turn that on earlier so that we could watch something. So it was off when you walked in this room. My point is... To me, the fact that they're doing this cruiserweight show tells me they have a fan in mind.
Yeah.
To me, that fan is not that interested in Swerved. But maybe I'm wrong. Because Swerved, I'm sure, as the new programming is what largely is getting the hours logged on this network.
I watched actually all episodes of Swerved.
Okay, so you have a better idea of it. I watched bits and pieces of it, and I didn't enjoy it all that much.
It wasn't an amazing show, but I think there's a real craving to see professional wrestling talents outside of the WWE, out of character, reacting in situations where they might not even know that they're being filmed. So I think that it has enough appeal for them to probably shoot it. If it's a show that seems like it costs nothing to do. And, you know, out of all the shows, it seemed to at least get a bit more buzz than your typical shows. I actually look forward to more episodes of Table for Three.
Yeah, which they haven't done any new ones of late.
I'm assuming WrestleMania weekend they'll bulk shoot a lot.
And the final thing, upcoming episodes of Legends with JBL with Booker T, Jimmy Hart, and Michael Hayes.
Together?
No, these will all, I assume, be individual one-on-one interviews. Michael Hayes will be entertaining, if nothing else.
Yeah.
Jimmy Hart will be Jimmy Hart.
Yeah.
And Booker T. Yeah, Booker T's, you know,
he'll be okay.
Fine, engaging man.
Yeah.
Have you watched any of the JBL interviews?
Yeah, I saw the Bischoff one. That was really good. What else?
Ron Simmons, he recently did.
Didn't see that one. The one with Sean and...
Oh, that's right. With Sean, Austin, and Hunter.
I actually didn't
discussing the Undertaker.
Didn't catch that one either.
Yeah, I forgot about that one. Well, there you go. That's some announcements. They're also going heavy on these pretty much playlists that they're putting together and packaging them as collections.
Playlists.
That's what they are.
Wow.
It's just clips of matches and angles involving guys like Daniel Bryan's greatest moments.
No, that's good. It's good of them to kind of repurpose that stuff. I think the part of the challenge of doing some of these services like a Netflix or the network is just telling people what you have, because there's so much stuff out there that it's none of it is really on the surface for you to see. So I'm fine with them doing things like that.
With all due respect to the WWE Network, the Daniel Bryan's greatest hits is going to come in second when it comes to a retrospective look on the man's career, which is what we're going to be diving into today. And there has been so much on Bryan Danielson over the last week and a half since his retirement announcement on Raw in Seattle. So we were going to take today to not so much give a nuts and bolts biography of Bryan Danielson, but like cherry pick some matches.
Yeah, I feel like we've done that.
We did do that a few months ago.
On a number of podcasts, including the Journey to WrestleMania, Just Say Yes, Yes, Yes DVD review that we did over the summer, which you can find on our archives and also on our YouTube channel. But also, we talk about Bryan at length for the first Wrestling Road Diaries. Review that we've done. So all in all, we've actually talked quite a bit about, you know, this man's career. But I think we want to take this opportunity to just rewatch a lot of his great matches, which we haven't necessarily done on this show yet.
I think my biggest conclusion after just watching back at a number of these matches and just all the options we had, which thank you to all the people that posted different you had such a wide variety, and it was amazing to see that as this guy's career ends and a lot of people were disappointed that he's retiring, it's not as if this guy is leaving, you know, all these dream matches on the table. This guy worked with so many people all over the world. I mean, we're going to talk about Danielson and Tanahashi. He had tag matches against Nakamura during his career. He had a six-man tag against Kenta Kobashi in Noah. He worked with everybody of the modern era on the independent level and in WWE in high-profile matches.
Or in small gymnasiums.
Very small gymnasiums that hardly had anybody inside of them. Yes.
Yeah, and absolutely. I think... certainly a lot of people are sad that he won't get a chance to perform on a large stage anymore, but you can go back and enjoy a Bryan Danielson match once a week for the rest of your life and probably still discover very new.
And so much of it is so readily accessible.
Maybe not the rest of your life, but for the rest of the year, okay? And you'll have a great time like I had watching a lot of these shows, because I never knew that they existed until a lot of you guys were able to post them up on that board. So thank you all for leaving just a great collection. So do check that out if you're craving for more. But this was a great excuse to go back and watch some of these, what in my mind were dream matches, and I was very excited to watch all of them.
Yeah, and we start off with... I think something we could literally call a dream match because...
Do you want to do the, are we doing this in chronological order?
Yes, I thought cool. That would make the most sense. I call this a dream match involving Bryan Danielson and AJ Styles because of the people that were in the gym, most of them were asleep, I think. This was September the 16th of 2004 for IWA Mid-South. It was an IWA homecoming in New Albany, Indiana. And wait, I wrote down my notes under 50 people in this gym. It may have been less than half that.
Yeah. Like, I don't think it's an exaggeration to say that there is maybe 20. Seriously.
I tried to count, and it was, I think I could have done it.
Like, I don't know what was up, because I think at this point, both of these two men probably had quite a bit of name value attached to them, right? Would this have been?
This was 2004. This was also a Thursday night show, because IWA Mid-South didn't always just run your traditional, like, weekend cards. I mean, in this one in particular, there was a card the night prior, and then they had the Ted Petty Invitational Tournament, for the late Ted Petty coming out of this that would go throughout the weekend. So you had a number of nights in a row that they were running. This was a Thursday night in New Albany, Indiana, which probably the population, probably half of them were here.
Yeah.
No disrespect to anyone in New Albany, Indiana. But this was, I mean, to say you're this is kind of, would be kind of a notch on your belt to say that you got to see Bryan Danielson and AJ Styles in front of 20 people.
Yeah, or perhaps you were one of the people asleep during this, because they're very clearly, I don't know, like, these people must have had a really slow day and, you know, they're really tired. But the setting is really perfect.
It was wonderful.
It was great in hindsight, knowing that what both of these men would go on to accomplish. You look at it, it's not just the crowd. There's a basketball hoop in the background, of course, like in any classic independent wrestling venue. There's always a basketball net. This looked like some type of garage where, like, there's like a half-open garage door in the back. Awful fluorescent lighting. The ring itself had rips all over it, duct tape plastered everywhere on the rings. A bunch of white folding chairs. You know, like we said, probably 80% of which were empty. And it was really the perfect setting to watch, you know, these two who are now performing on the biggest stage, or one of them.
Yeah. And of course, IWA Mid-South was Ian Rotten's promotion, and they were starting to get a lot of buzz because they were doing very unconventional independent matches at the time with CM Punk and his whole crew, with Colt Cabana and Chris Hero. Of course, Dave Prezak here was on commentary, but they started doing like these 90-minute matches. There was a match with him and Hero that went, I want to say, like an hour 45. Stuff that just was the sheer length of it was so novel at the time that here these guys are in front of, you know, probably 100 or less people and doing these matches that you look back today at, and some of the talent that was there at IWA Mid-South, it was pretty impressive.
Yeah. And with all that said, you know, there was no indication that whatever, how small the crowd was had any effect on how hard these two were going. These two were wrestling. I'm sure they would have had the same match if there was nobody around.
Yeah, we had Bryce Remsburg as the referee, and then Dave Prezak on commentary with Eddie Kingston, a loyal Fight Network viewer, by the way.
Is that true?
Yeah, I had a nice conversation with him the last House of Hardcore show in Toronto. They started things off with this Greco-Roman knuckle lock, each bridging out from the other. And Danielson is playing heel throughout this match, complaining about Styles pulling his trunks. There was a great sequence with each escaping. And then Styles landed this great drop kick, and a back body drop sends Styles to the floor. And Danielson follows with a pescado that misses Styles. And then Danielson lands on the concrete. Styles hits his own. Then there was the working over of the arm by Styles, applying a Fujiwara armbar and focusing on the arm. Danielson then worked into an abdominal stretch and then a crossface, and tells the fans to stop their clapping for AJ Styles. I very much enjoyed Danielson, especially in 2004, playing this heel role. And this was also at a time when AJ Styles, you know, certainly Danielson was getting a lot of focus through his Ring of Honor outlet, but AJ Styles, this was well into TNA's tenure. They weren't on Spike yet, but they were, this was just before they got onto the Sunday night pay-per-view slots. So Styles was certainly a name at the time to this audience.
Yeah, he had a brief stint at the end of WCW as well.
That's right. Air Styles.
Paris.
Yeah, that was his partner.
Oh.
It was Air Styles and Air Paris.
Air Raid.
Air Raid. That's right.
Yes.
And then Danielson goes for a cover, and when Styles kicks out, he admonishes Bryce Remsburg, saying, "That's the closest to three I've ever seen." And then it's a knee to the lower back by Danielson. He applies the San Martino-style backbreaker, goes for another abdominal stretch, which is turned into a gut wrench, and Danielson yells at the 10 people, "Show your approval for my moves." And, I mean, the guy was very funny just working off of people.
Yeah, he's a fantastic heel.
Yeah, grabbing Styles, and he, of course, one of his famous calls, he's saying, "I have until five." And then it hits an airplane spin to Styles, goes counterclockwise, and both get dizzy and go down. Goes for a belly-to-back superplex, which would be a common spot for Bryan Danielson, but Styles reverses the belly-to-back superplex, landing on top, and this allows Styles to make his comeback, hits a spin kick, went for a backflip out of the corner for an inverted DDT, but did not hit it, and then Styles gets crotched on the top, takes a belly-to-back superplex, and then Styles blocks the cattle mutilation, hits a Pele kick, which did get an applause from the crowd. They watched all of this, and it was the Pele kick that finally got their approval. They traded headbutts, safe ones, and then there's a German. Styles lands on his feet. Styles then holds on to Danielson for the Styles clash, and as he lifts him up, Danielson headbutts him and applies the cattle mutilation and rolls into a backslide, pinning Styles at 19 minutes and 28 seconds, and this audience probably had no clue, or at least some of them had no clue of what they had just seen or where these two would go, which, to be fair, in 2004, I would not have predicted either.
Yeah. Yeah, it really is amazing. You know, watching these matches, I just thought it was one of the things I really enjoyed about it was to get to see the cattle mutilation again. Mm-hmm. I think it's just such a wonderful move. And Bryan has just so many awesome transitions into and out of it. And you notice that he actually kind of sets it up like the Yes Lock, and then he jumps into the bridge, and he's able to follow that up with a bunch of different combinations with the chicken wings. Just great. And I'm a little sad he dropped that move in the WWE, but I guess in hindsight, it might be a little tougher to kind of get a move like that off on, you know, some of the larger opponents that he had. The match I felt was mainly all Bryan working a lot of his offense, working his style of match with a lot of grounded maneuvers. And AJ, you know, typically maybe known as more of a high flyer, was able to keep up very well on the ground with Bryan. Really stiff. All these matches on the indies that we're gonna review from Daniel Bryan, just incredibly stiff strikes, really hard arm drags, hard shoulder tackles, and it's a little bit. It made me a little uncomfortable watching these, considering, you know, knowing all.
Oh, this wouldn't be the match that made me the most.
No, they're worse. But even on a match like this, to an audience of 20 people, these guys were going very hard, and. It was a very good match, and I was very impressed, and I really like watching Bryan play this cocky, honestly almost scary and intimidating heel, who he almost played like this kind of psychotic, sadistic dude in just how violent he was in the ring. And it's just a real far cry from kind of what we got even during his heel run in the WWE, which was always more of that of, you know, kind of like the laid back, friendly underdog.
Yeah, and I like the fact that we picked this match because it did showcase those aspects to Danielson, because I always felt that when he got tagged as indie darling, no charisma, no personality, this, that, you can watch stuff like this. He could do comedy if he chose to. Mm. He could do, which he especially got to hone in when he would go to England and work those shows, incorporating different comedy. He could work heel. The guy to me was never a bad promo. Mm-hmm. I mean, certainly, and you look at him, and yes, on surface level, you just look at him as very bland looking.
He doesn't have the delivery of The Rock or typically what's expected of, you know, like an 80s screaming type of promo.
Yes, but to say he had no personality, I think, was just a very lazy conclusion to make of the guy. And I think he himself was as critical as anyone about his own shortcomings. But you get to see something like this in 2004. Mm. I mean, this was a guy. He may have not been the personality of Dwayne Johnson. Few are going to be, but charisma comes in many different forms, and I always felt that he had it. Mm-hmm. Next up, we go just a few, actually 1 month later, October the 24th of 2004, and we're going over to Japan as Bryan Danielson takes on Hiroshi Tanahashi.
quite an interesting match to go back and watch 12 years ago.
Yeah, what stage was Tanahashi at
this? This was when Tanahashi was the U30 champion, which was a title that was largely created for Tanahashi. Nakamura would get a run with it, and the criteria was, much like the cruiserweight title would have weight limits, this had age limits. You could not be 30 and hold this title. So this was Tanahashi defending the U30 championship against Bryan Danielson, who had been doing tours now at this point with New Japan Pro Wrestling. And this had been a tour that was largely consisting of tag matches that Danielson was a part of. And this was where he actually did get to work Nakamura in a tag match on, I believe, two different occasions. And if you go back to this tour, it was Danielson primarily teaming with James Gibson, Jamie Noble. And if you can find some of these matches, it's tag matches involving Danielson taking on Nakamura, Tenzan, Minoru Suzuki, Jushin Liger, which are, I haven't seen the tag with Minoru Suzuki, but imagine those two together, for instance. So some interesting stuff that you can go back and see. So Tanahashi is the U30 champion. He had also gone to the finals of the G1 prior that summer, losing to Tenzan in the finals. So you could certainly see, while he hadn't won an IWGP title yet, he was certainly poised along with Shinsuke Nakamura as the two guys that they looked at as their future at a time when New Japan was in the dumps in 2004, and it was going to get worse before it would get better. They started off with a number of hammerlock reversals, each is trying to control the arm. Danielson used a leg vine, and then Tanahashi broke free. The crowd applauded this. Danielson then wrenches back on the right arm of Tanahashi and is putting lots of pressure on him, lands a drop kick, and then a suicide dive as Superman flies to the floor.
Right into the guardrail.
Right in, crashes into it, and yells, "Fuck! Fuck!" holding his ribs. So this was unsettling.
Yeah.
These were the metal barricades too. This is with not like the ones the WWE has now. This was like head into metal.
Mm-hmm.
That was breaking your fall.
Yeah. In, it was wonderfully set up, you know, following the beautiful chain wrestling that preceded it. I mean, I watch it, and it was just a joy to see Bryan Danielson do his chain wrestling with Hiroshi Tanahashi. The two of them are just had really good chemistry in that department. And part of me wonders if he could have made a comeback to the WWE and if he would have prolonged his career just working that portion of the match. He probably wouldn't have had it. You know, he probably, if he couldn't, you know, do things like a suicide dive, he probably would rather just not.
Well, remember the interview he did around, I want to say a year ago. I think this was when he was dealing with the neck problems and having the full use of his arm, the full strength in the arm, and stating that he was preparing to come back where he just couldn't use that part of his body.
Yeah.
So he was going to build a whole style around, you know, because of nerve damage and such.
Not using his
left arm. I feel he 100% could have changed his style to this, but I also feel he ultimately wouldn't. As much as Danielson, I think, is one of the most intelligent people you're going to speak to in wrestling, this guy had some of the most reckless and ambitious style that he would. I mean, this is a guy who got a stinger on live television and wanted to continue a match. I mean, this was somebody that certainly, I think, understood all of these risks, but was also willing to ignore them.
Yeah, and that's for better or worse. You can argue that the quality of his matches wouldn't have been that great without a quality like that. But I would have loved to have just seen a portion of Daniel Bryan's career where he just strictly did submissions. Just strictly was a ground wrestler. And I watched this and it felt a lot like a jiu-jitsu demo, which, I mean, I'm a real nerd for just a lot of subtle techniques flowing from one position to another, and he seemed to excel at that.
Tanahashi is constantly going for the dragon sleeper. Danielson hits a flying uppercut off the turnbuckle and then a dragon screw leg whip as Tanahashi is now selling his left knee. Danielson works it over with a figure four. They get a rope break. Tanahashi is then seated on the top and takes a drop kick, and then Danielson falls with a superplex, a diving headbutt as the crowd picks up. Danielson gets a two count off of that. Both kick out of small packages, which again, a finish that Danielson got over, the unbreakable small package. And Danielson goes for a belly-to-back superplex from the top. Tanahashi reverses, lands on top, and then a dragon suplex is countered with a roll-up for two by Danielson. Tanahashi calls for it again, this time hitting the dragon suplex, which was his finish pre-high fly flow, and pins Danielson at 16-17, retaining the U30 championship as his biggest opponent is a calendar.
I thought this was a great match. I thought both men gelled really well. I'm just grateful that, you know, we got to see these two wrestle each other in a singles match at least once on camera. And I'm sure they would have had excellent matches anytime they would have faced each other in the future. If that were to happen.
And that's the interesting what if of Danielson when you look at that summer of 2010, where that was at the point when New Japan was ready to offer and Danielson was ready to sign a deal with New Japan. Had he come in 2010, mm-hmm. he would have been part of that whole main event mix we've been watching for the last 6 years. On top of that, that was when Paul Heyman was very much in talks with TNA and his plan was to build everything around Kurt Angle and Bryan Danielson eventually getting to a match. And Danielson could have been part of both New Japan and TNA and how differently things would have been. And the fact is, Wei, he could have had the exact same punishment on his body, and odds are he'd be wrestling today because I don't think the testing would have been as extensive outside of WWE.
Yeah, which...
And I think that's the better that he was aware of this. Mm-hmm. I don't know if he necessarily would have been going through all the channels he did outside of WWE. Mm-hmm. Our third match is August the 25th of 2007. ROH World Champion Takeshi Morishima defending the title against former champion Bryan Danielson. And the story of this is that it's the first title match for Danielson since he lost the title at Final Battle the prior year to Homicide after holding the title since September of 2005 and having that outstanding title run.
Mm-hmm.
So this match was nuts.
Yeah,
we can agree on that. Yeah. And this crowd at the Manhattan Center was just on fire for this match from start to finish.
Yeah.
Everything that New Albany, Indiana lacked, Manhattan made up for.
Yeah. The room, the size of the room might have been about the same, but it was maybe 200 times more people.
Yeah, there are about 2,275 more people in this arena.
What do you remember about the Takeshi Morishima ROH title run?
Just it was a very unconventional change at the time, but one that I thought was – certainly they were strengthening their relationship with Noah, and here was a big sign of good faith, taking Morishima over, putting the title on someone, and making him your killer world champion. That
was Gabe the Booker?
Yes.
This time?
Yes. He was there until the fall of 2008. So he was very much booking all of this at the time. And I think that Morishima, I mean, he was someone that ultimately, I mean, his weight really just got out of control and his career was hurt by injuries. I think part of that was carrying so much weight and working the physical style that he did. But I thought that Morishima was going to have a much longer run than he did. And, you know, the comparisons were always made to him with Terry Gordy. And unfortunately, his size and that style, it just didn't help being that size and the issues you deal with when you're working this kind of style.
Yeah. But boy, like, you know, he definitely made great use of the time that he did have, because this was tremendous.
Danielson starts off with these inside and outside leg kicks. I imagine this was already where he was training at Extreme Couture, and leg kicks, despite what Cecil Peoples might tell you, I mean, they can end fights, and I think that's what Danielson was incorporating here. He mixed in forearms in the corner. Morishima then gets him in the corner and just unloads these huge strikes, drops Danielson and starts killing him with strikes, and it turned into this one-sided beatdown. I don't know which shot it was, but there was one key blow that would lead to Bryan Danielson's retina becoming detached, and this was the opening minutes of the match, and they would go 20 here.
Yeah, Danielson in a promo described it as one of the punches in the corner.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But it could have been any number of strikes following this, because there's a lot more blows to the head following this.
Like, Bryan Danielson probably would have thrown a fit if anyone tried to stop this match.
Oh, yeah.
Like, his eye literally rolled back in the locker room afterwards.
Oh.
It was pretty nuts. He had to have surgery either the next day or the Monday after this. And this is the reason why everyone would talk about, oh, Danielson trains. I wonder if he could ever do MMA like CM Punk. It's like this injury, no commission would ever allow him because of his vision issues, because of this retina tear. And the fact that he went another 20 minutes here, it's kind of insane that that can happen.
So insane. Working this style of match against the man who is probably several, 50 pounds more than you, at least. And wasn't there, like, you mentioned how pissed he would have been if somebody stopped the match. Didn't that actually happen in the WWE and we actually got to see him get rid
of that's style? What I was mentioning before, the stinger he had.
Oh, right.
Where Triple H made the call to stop it with Randy Orton. It was a 2013 Raw. And then Brian just blew up on Hunter backstage. Mm. And that's the mentality that so many of these guys had. And I can't even tell you confidently that if this exact same scenario happened today in a Ring of Honor, even a WWE ring, I can't 100% tell you they would stop the match.
They probably wouldn't know the severity of the injury at the right in the middle of the match.
Well, I think that would be a case. Like, it was obvious here that the eye was a problem. Like, yeah. It was visual here. I mean, the announcing was done all in post, mm-hmm. So that's after the fact. But you could see his eye was a mess early on and couldn't even have it opened. Mm. Like, there was a serious problem there. And wrestling 20 minutes at this style, this pace.
He could have been permanently.
Of course
blind.
He could. This could have ended his career. Mm. He could have lost his eye as a result of this. They go to the floor. Danielson is on a chair and takes a running boot to the face against the metal barricade. His head was lodged against the metal barricade.
With a detached retina.
And a boot to the face.
Yep.
He's having trouble seeing out of the eye as Morishima gets sent over the barricade and Danielson hits a springboard crossbody, clearing the barricade to the audience.
Yeah. He can probably do it blind. You can probably still do that.
Danielson went for a knee bar, and he is clutching the side of his head. I wouldn't doubt, Way, that he had the worst headache on top of this because his vision was such a mess. He probably thought he had vertigo.
Yeah, I've never detached the retina.
Well, probably not a good idea. Have you ever got poked in the eye in jiu-jitsu or anything?
Probably, yeah.
I got one once, and I broke a blood vessel,
ooh.
And it was just the worst.
How did you get poked from jiu-jitsu?
I was just rolling with a guy who was being aggressive, and I felt the finger go in, man. And it was just – I immediately like
– You took 5 minutes.
Oh, there was blood, and it was like afterwards, like my pupil, like you could see like red all around it, and I had to get it checked out, and they're like, you're okay, but it's – Man, that stuff is just, you've got to be so careful with your eyes.
Yeah.
It's really hard to watch. And stuff with eyes, like just, it turns my stomach, man. I have a real weakness when it comes to eyes. Oh, I just watched.
So eyes and smirks you don't like.
Oh, that scene on the last episode of Jessica Jones with Luke Cage.
What?
Remember they can't put a needle into his arm.
Oh, and they poked him in, yeah.
Oh man, I had to turn away. I couldn't watch it, man. Like eyes, I can't do. Eye injuries are just, I'll throw up.
Okay. Good to know.
Yeah. So I'm warning you right now. I'm going to heave. The crowd is rallying for Danielson. It's a bridging German for a near fall, downward elbows onto the chest of Morishima. More leg kicks. Morishima finally collapses down. And then Danielson grabs the arms and starts curb stomping Morishima to the mat over and over. Gets another near fall. Applies the cattle mutilation. This crowd is going batshit. He makes it to the bottom rope for the break. Then we have a belly-to-back superplex, and Morishima reverses it. This is like Flair climbing to the top.
Yep.
Danielson going for this superplex. Then there's forearms from Morishima, big lariat, backdrop driver, and he wins at 20 minutes and 18 seconds. And Danielson couldn't see out of his left eye, needed surgery right after. This was August the 25th, and he would take all of 3 weeks off and return on September 14th, where he would wrestle two matches that day. And then the next day on 15th, rematch with Morishima.
It really
that was the recovery process for Danielson. 3 fucking weeks for this detached retina.
Yeah. He's got a tremendous promo that's somewhere on YouTube right now where he...
With the patch?
With the eye patch, talking about this incident and how he went to the eye doctor with his mom and his mom was bawling, telling him to quit this insanity. And he also makes mention of how, his dad, he had a conversation with his dad and his dad told him that, you know, to keep pursuing his dreams basically. In hindsight, you know, it was just a very, very interesting promo, especially knowing, you know, the guy that eventually did retire. But at this time, I'm sure it was at least somewhat debated about finally not wrestling, following a very severe injury like this.
Yeah, I think that, I mean, the weird nature about pro wrestling is that when there is a big injury and it's worked into the match. I mean, it does add something to a match. You can't deny that. And this crowd was so hot for this. This got 4.75 stars by Dave Meltzer.
Yeah.
Certainly a match of the year candidate. But this was too...
The crowd wouldn't even have known about the eye injury.
No, I don't think they would have clued in on it.
But to watch it, knowing that he did detach his retina, made this... It made the match great, but at the same time, it made it tough to watch because this was a real injury that we knew this guy was going through. But also, again, an incredible feat to an incredible showing of heart. The fact that he was able to have this style of match for 20 minutes with his eye injuries like that.
This was an unbelievable match, but this to me was just, it's not what I really want to endorse and give off that. This is what performers should be striving to achieve when they're met with something as serious as a retina injury. I think that there is a certain line that at the end of the day, it's a fucking wrestling match and a guy's health is much more important. And, that's where I have my issues with this match. But I mean, it's an incredible match. Mm-hmm. There's no denying that.
Morishima was just a whole lot of fun to watch. You know, much like Samoa Joe, just this big guy who can work that power style with the letter guys, but also agile and quick for his size. And the story they told was very simple. It was just Danielson trying to chop this guy down. The moment when Morishima finally takes a knee, this crowd really jumped up, and it felt like a really big moment. I thought the storytelling was fantastic in the match.
We're going to fast forward at this point all the way to 2010. So this was after Bryan Danielson had been released by the WWE following the infamous Tai incident during the Nexus attack in June, and Danielson lined up. He had no shortage of independent promoters come calling, and he got to do what turned into quite the several month catalog of matches that he was able to put together that probably he thought that this part of his career wasn't going to happen again, to go out on the independents. And here we get Bryan Danielson and Tommy End from July the 4th of that year in 2010 in Oberhausen, Germany for the WXW Ambition tournament. And this was unlike any of the other matches that we're reviewing today, and I'm really glad you included this one because it's short, but I enjoyed it so much.
Yeah, this was a match where it was part of a one-night eight-man tournament, and I don't know if the entire tournament had these rules, but this, at least this particular match, was done with a very shoot style influence, very reminiscent of, you know, what we've seen in pro wrestling with the UWF or Battle Arts. And this match even had a standing eight count.
Mm-hmm.
And I decided to watch it, number one, because Tommy End is really gaining a lot of attention right now on the independent scene, and it was nice to see this incarnation.
He's a guy I could totally see in that Cruiserweight show.
Oh, cool.
How
big is he?
Yeah,
though?
You're right. He's probably, I don't know how legit we're going to hold this 205 pound deal to.
Mm-hmm. But Tommy in from Amsterdam with some legit kickboxing background.
Part of Stefan Struve's gym.
And we got to see him taking on Bryan Danielson here, who, and the two of them decided to have a very MMA based match. And, you know, MMA, faux MMA in a pro wrestling match can come off.
Some hate it.
Bad. But I like to just, I love it. Like, when it's done well. And I thought it was, you can't take, like, I tried to watch these matches with Robin and Randy, and they can't accept it.
Sure.
Because, you know, oh, that doesn't look like a takedown. That doesn't look like a proper, you know, Kimura. But you gotta suspend your disbelief and just think about a pro wrestling match with the intent of exciting the crowd. And, you know, not every, not every technique is going to look superb, but it's just more so the idea and the timing of everything. And you know, by the end of it, you're using an MMA framework to have a professional wrestling match. And I thought these two did tremendously. I got to see Brian use a lot of his jiu-jitsu-based offense in this match, and it was a lot of fun to watch.
This venue was so tiny that there was no hope of Danielson doing a full Final Countdown-style entrance. He was out before I think even the lyrics began on the song. We had to cut that one short. The match begins with End hitting this flying knee and striking Danielson down. I mean, this was almost kind of like Cal Uno, BJ Penn, although he hit the flying knee to start the match and didn't miss and then get obliterated. And then they start to grapple as Danielson recovers from this early onslaught, gets his back and into a calf crusher, and then a rope break by Tommy End. This ring was so small. I mean, to do submissions, it was very tough because all you had to do was stretch your arms and odds are you were going to find a rope. Mm-hmm. Very tiny ring. There was a takedown and then a lapel lock attempt into the ropes. Danielson is using leg kicks, and I enjoyed this a lot because they just escalated and escalated. And Tommy End's selling of these leg kicks, by the end, this man was crippled. This was the most realistic selling of leg kicks, because this is what will happen in any MMA fight where you see a guy, the first leg kick he lands and the guy tries to smile it off, by leg kick number 6, that guy is switching stances.
Yes.
Or can't even take another leg kick.
It was a progressive wearing down of the legs to the point where, much like the Morishima match, the big moment was when you couldn't get back up.
There were knees from the clinch by End, more leg kicks and strikes on top by Danielson, goes for a knee bar, again, a rope break, and then Danielson hits this leg kick, and the crowd reacts so well because of the selling by End. They know how vicious these are. Charges at End with two more just machine gun leg kicks to the left leg of Tommy End, and they cheer for End to get up. He collapses twice, and the fight gets waved off. And I wrote fight down here when I was recapping a MMA bout here. It ends at 7 minutes and 4 seconds. I thought that this was a lot of fun to watch, and this crowd was so appreciative of the style.
Yeah.
This may have fell flat if you were in front of
WWE.
Another crowd. Oh, 100%. This would not happen there. But this crowd was great.
Yeah. And I think a match like this just kind of goes to show the colorful independent wrestling career that Bryan Danielson has had, where he can travel the world and work a variety of different styles against a variety of different opponents and be able to be very convincing in all of them. It was a lot of fun for me to kind of see Bryan work some of his jiu-jitsu influence. He loves his omoplatas, that's for sure. Yeah, I thought this was a lot of fun. I if there are more out there, please send them my way, because I'd love to see Danielson do more of these types of matches.
Yeah, Tommy End is a lot of fun to watch if you are a fan of the UK scene. He's working more now with Pro Wrestling Guerrilla, and I think that guy, he is going to get scooped up at some point. If he is still unsigned by the end of this year, I would be very surprised. We go to September of 2010. At this point, Danielson had returned at SummerSlam, but still had independent dates that he had to fulfill, and this was going to be his last outside date before going full-time WWE. So Bryan Danielson taking on Jon Moxley at Way of the Ronin 2010 for Dragon Gate USA in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. And this was cool to go back and watch. I had not watched this match prior, but getting to see Jon Moxley in his ultimate heel form, which you don't get to see this version of him at all in WWE. At some point you might, but I guess just watching Jon Moxley here, it's right down to your favorite way, the explicit content warning trunks that he wore.
Oh, he had those
on his
back.
Yeah,
I guess so.
With Mox written on them. This was 2010, so still a little late to the game on the explicit warning knockoff.
The Dudleys actually have a new shirt.
That's right. They've got the more, it's like the straight out of Compton look.
Yes. Yeah, it was really nice to see Jon Moxley in his full kind of heel mode here.
His gimmick was he was a piece of shit.
Yep. And he also was a womanizer who was abusive to women yet had some type of weird grasp of them.
Which just randomly slapped this woman that was in his corner.
Yeah. There was a ton of heat for this just from the get-go. And, I mean, I, I'm wondering how much was Brian like? Did he have a long run in Dragon Gate during this time, or was it like?
Yeah, he did select shows for them in between, but really, you're looking at from July to September, so it's not like they're running a ton of shows in that short amount of time.
On commentary, they mentioned how Moxley was kind of doing a lot of build up for this match online via promos, and
that's where he really, to me, established his presence. Was not so much just the in-ring, but his character work that he would post promos. They were very good promos, yep. And was becoming that character. And I think he's a guy that I think very much goes outside the box. I think if you listen years ago when he was on Colt Cabana's show, he very much did it as this guy who just kind of looks down upon the independent scene and just, I think, very much becomes that character. Mm-hmm. And that's what he tries to get across. I mean, he's very much a different breed than your typical 30-something wrestler, 20-something wrestler even.
And today. I think definitely somebody who probably came along at the perfect time with, you know, everything that is available digitally in social media to be able to still keep the attention of your audience when you're not wrestling via, you know, his wonderful character work. He definitely just seemed like he was already world class in terms of his promos and charisma even before he stepped foot into the WWE.
Moxley comes out and says how all the fans here have come to see him get his fucking head kicked in, and the crowd chants that at him. Moxley notes he's been drinking whiskey all day and then ran for an hour and then slaps his valet in the face prior to the match, and she smiles. Danielson charges and attacks Moxley and immediately goes for the cattle mutilation, cannot get him, and starts elbowing Moxley and then hits a suicide dive to the floor. Moxley posts Danielson twice and then just shoves his valet over. And they note that he has some strange hold over these women he brings to ringside. Danielson is bleeding from the post shot, and Moxley attacks the wound, works the left shoulder of Danielson. They're brawling around the building. They come back into the ring, and Danielson starts kicking him in the chest. Moxley attacks the left arm. There's a Fujiwara armbar, and then he puts the weight onto the knee. And then Danielson goes to his back, tries for a triangle, and this is where the commentary does bring up his training at Extreme Couture in Las Vegas. There's a missile dropkick by Danielson into an ace crusher, and then Moxley gets a two count, escapes a crossface chicken wing, and then Danielson drops elbows on him, applies the cattle mutilation. Moxley goes to the bottom rope. The crowd is, at this point, they're trying to just get, I thought that there would be silence at times, and someone would just have to yell out a joke. And it just became annoying at times with this audience. Like, they were very much amateur stand-up comedians in the crowd, which is one of my bigger pet peeves in indie shows. Then they traded big boots. There's a headbutt to the chest and a head kick by Danielson. A kick to the head on the ground, and Danielson yells, he's going to get his fucking head kicked in, as this crowd went nuts to the callback.
And that was the threat, yeah. Earlier on. Yeah.
And then starts curb stomping him, LaBelle lock, and Moxley taps out at 14:58.
A very good and another very hard-hitting match. I mean, all these matches we've seen, you watch them all, especially in succession, and you really don't have to wonder why this man might be retiring at an early age. Just such an incredibly physical, taxing style, and he probably did this every night for years.
After the match, Danielson offers his hand to Moxley, and then Gran Akuma jumps him from behind. They're part of the Kamikaze USA faction, Akuma and Moxley. And then Moxley applies the chicken wing, and Jimmy Jacobs runs in with a chair to clear the ring and hugs Danielson. And then Danielson goes to get on the microphone for his farewell to the Dragon Gate USA audience. And Jacobs wants a front row seat for this speech. He goes to sit on the chair, and the chair breaks, and Jacobs falls on his ass, and Danielson, thinking on his feet, states, isn't that the story of your entire career? Mm-hmm. And then thanks the crowd for being awesome, says this is most likely my last appearance for Dragon Gate USA, and says that there is always a good chance he could get fired again by the WWE, and explains that Fans had to wait tonight an extra hour because 2 hours before the show, there wasn't even a ring tonight, and puts over all the guys in the back who helped put this show together and singles out Jimmy Jacobs, who he states is a guy that has enough tenure that he doesn't have to be on the ring crew, but volunteered to put the ring together and just goes out of his way to put over Jimmy Jacobs, stating that, "I know a lot of you probably came to see me tonight, but I hope all of you come back to watch the Jimmy Jacobs of the world." And once again, Bryan Danielson, again, maybe the nicest man to ever populate this industry.
Really nice. And Jimmy Jacobs is a part of the
Now he's WWE. A writer with WWE, so mm-hmm. he made it on his own way to the company.
And I think in 2010, after his time in the WWE, we saw a transition from, you know, all the matches that we watched prior was just of definitely an R-rated version of Daniel Bryan, Bryan Danielson, where he just, again, played this psychotic, very sadistic, you know, killer in the ring. Here, he was still very hard-hitting and very vicious, but he had seemed to have begun to develop that nice guy, sensitive guy character. And, you know, he would kind of see that to full effect towards the end of his career.
And this will go down as Bryan Danielson's last independent match ever, at least as we sit here today.
For now.
Always that chance, I guess. The final match we're going to review is from SummerSlam 2013. We did want to have a WWE match represented here in our retrospective look. And while it won't go down as Bryan Danielson's most famous match in the WWE, it was a very important match. His first, I would say, headlining match. He was very much a part of at TLC for the Shield match, which didn't go on last. I would say this was his most high profile match up until this point in August of 2013 at the Staples Center. John Cena defending the title against Bryan. This one went on last and had the difficulty of having to follow Brock Lesnar and CM Punk, which was excellent that night at the same show. And the story with the video starting this was that John Cena was allowed to pick his opponent for this particular pay-per-view, and he chose Daniel Bryan. And this was all based around Vince hating the idea that this troll could become champion, and it was Triple H defending Bryan and telling Vince to keep an open mind. And Hunter would be named the guest referee for the match. And going into this match, John Cena was coming in with a left elbow injury, which turned out to be a partially torn triceps that he worked through, and was supposed to work this match and take 4 to 5 months off, and instead return 9 weeks later. One of John Cena's many insane recovery periods. Amazing. So that takes us into this match, and very hot crowd to close off SummerSlam this particular year. Had you watched this at the time?
I think so.
So Cena starts and gets sent into the steps, and the crowd is very much chanting loudly for Bryan. They're chanting, "You still suck," at Cena. And one thing is for sure, when you have this kind of audience, John Cena is so good at playing that role when the audience clearly has their favorite and they hate John Cena.
Mm-hmm.
I think he very much tailors the match for this audience when it happens, when it's a Rob Van Dam at One Night Stand, when it's a CM Punk at Money in the Bank, and in this case, everyone behind Daniel Bryan in this match.
Yeah, he doesn't seem to get shaken by it at all.
Here's this guy with a partially torn triceps gutting his way through a 25-minute match, and this audience just hates him. Mm-hmm. So Cena gets into control. Bryan comes back with punches, kicks in the corner, very big reaction. There's kicks to the chest of Cena, to his knees, ducks one to the head, and Cena shoulder tackles him with a slam. At first, the five-knuckle shuffle is stopped with Bryan kicking him in the head off of his back, and then Cena tries it again with a slam and hits the five-knuckle shuffle. Then an AA, and Bryan lands on his feet, hits a missile dropkick. Cena's left eye got swollen here at one point. Not the worst eye injury of our retrospective look. Bryan then applies the STF. There's a bridging German for a two count, and then keeps hold of Cena's waist as he hits another one. Cena goes for an AA. It gets blocked. Bryan applies the yes lock, and Cena's able to get out of it. And then Bryan locks in a guillotine off of his back. Cena gets out of that and hits the AA. Bryan kicks out of the AA. And then Cena gets stopped on the turnbuckle. Bryan falls with a running drop kick, takes a superplex as Bryan stays in the tree of woe and then launches himself off the turnbuckle with a flying headbutt. There's a suicide dive that gets blocked by Cena with a forearm from the arm. And then he lifts Bryan onto his shoulders on the turnbuckle, gets stopped with downward elbows, and Bryan sets up for a top rope Frankensteiner. It gets blocked, and Cena holds him like in the Styles Clash position, but he doesn't hit the Styles Clash. Instead, he hops off the second turnbuckle with Bryan's head crashing down into the mat and then lifts him up for an AA, which Bryan reverses and into the Yes Lock.
I think he missed the head. Like, he was aware.
This looked dangerously close.
Oh, yeah. If you've seen Jericho versus Tyson Kidd a couple years back,
right,
he did that same spot where it looked so risky.
This should not be allowed. This sequence.
Very, very risky, yeah.
There were running drop kicks in the corner by Bryan. On the third, he gets cut off by a Cena clothesline. They're trading leg kicks, forearms. Both are down. Bryan goes for a high cross, which is caught, and Cena hoists him onto his shoulders. Bryan counters with a Toru Yano-style cradle and gets a two count, gets up, and then comes out of the corner with the running knee. This is the first time Bryan had ever done this, the Fuseku knee of Kenta from Noah. The guy who, I mean, should be getting royalties off half the finish spots in WWE by this point. And Bryan pins him with this finish that he had never used before in WWE at 26:54. And this crowd, they reacted big, but I think they were just as stunned as anything that Bryan won the title here, even though Cena was hurt. I think in the nature of which he lost, I mean, a totally unselfish loss by John Cena. He lost clean in the middle to Bryan.
Yeah, yeah, and probably at a time when it felt right to do it. I mean, I think I remember during this time, I think everybody still remembers this time when, you know, there's that real upswell of support. The Yes thing was kind of starting up, and I think everybody wanted to see Bryan with the title, and we weren't sure if they were going to execute. And they kind of did. But yep. Not really.
This was Daniel Bryan's 6.5-minute title reign before Randy Orton came out. Triple H turned on Bryan, hitting him with the pedigree, and Randy Orton cashed in, winning the title. And this would send Bryan on the most bizarre path throughout the rest of the year and into WrestleMania the next year, of which on this night in August of 2013, there is no way you could have predicted what was going to happen over the next number of months.
No. Definitely not.
Nor could the WWE have predicted this in August of 2013.
Yeah, and I think history will probably kind of hide most of the...
It already is.
Most of the inane and insane booking that took place in the next several months. Everything kind of ended up being very happy. He won the title at WrestleMania, the end. But it wasn't really a straight and narrow path like that. The match here was very good. It's noticeably a very different style for Daniel Bryan comparing this to, let's say, his AJ Styles match in 2004. It's still very physical, but not nearly as stiff as some of the others. More of a reliance on kind of repetition and familiarity of a moveset versus, I think, you know, back, in his indie days, he was a bit more varied in his, offense, and I would say even more technical, with some of the subtleties in the submissions. But, not my favorite of the six matches, but I think it was really nice to see him wrestle all the way from a small gymnasium to the main event of SummerSlam.
It leaves, Daniel Bryan in a very interesting spot, though, coming out of this. And what, I guess he would just chase Randy Orton now for the next while?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a great spot, you know, because Daniel Bryan was made into, you know, I mean, he had those wins over Randy Orton, so that all made sense.
Yep.
You know, he can beat him, and the people are really behind him.
Yep.
You know, I mean, that was the thing in the show, because I thought that Punk and Lesnar was the best match on the show, but the people were so wanting Daniel Bryan to win the championship that it made that match, you know, on par, because they just, you know, like with Punk and Lesnar, I don't think that they wanted Punk to win, but it wasn't that important to them as much as just seeing a brutal match. With Daniel Bryan and Cena, it was so important. They really wanted Daniel Bryan to get his moment. And so, you know, he really has that kind of momentum. And it's good that people are put in the position of going, well, he can win it. They're not afraid to put him over for it. but he doesn't have it, and we got Randy Orton with it, who, you know, is now a heel.
It's also worth noting the business that SummerSlam did this year, because this was Bryan putting his biggest position yet during his time in WWE. And when the numbers came out, this show did 296 buys worldwide, 186,000 domestic, which were way down from the year prior. And they, Vince McMahon flat out said that the main attraction was, clearly didn't click with our audience. And you can look at the fact that this was certainly built around Cena and Bryan in the top spot, along with Punk and Lesnar, but the fact was the year prior, which was built around Brock and Triple H, did significantly more business on pay-per-view. And that was somewhat a strike against Bryan, which was something that he would have to deal with going into the fall. And as much as this audience was behind him when he was put in this big position, it was down from the year prior. So he had that working against him as he went into all of these issues in the fall and the following year. So that's worth noting. However, WrestleMania that following year, even with the network launching, it did a very, very healthy number. And I think Daniel Bryan, he was the main star going into WrestleMania that year and deserves a lot of credit for that, even with the network launching. So that wraps up our look at six of Bryan Danielson's matches. There are about 6,000 more you could probably find online through whatever means and check it out. It's very fun to go back and watch a lot of these matches and the different styles, the different opponents. And I mean, it's not like he worked everybody of his generation, but he worked with a lot of guys.
A lot of hidden gems out there. And you know, a lot of these matches you'd be able to find versions of online, but I think we really should state that these are independent companies. Support them however you can. Buy a DVD. I'm sure a lot of them have Daniel Bryan collections available, so I do recommend everybody search those out.
Yeah, I would throw everybody to, you know, places like Smart Mark Video, WWN Live, High Spots, a lot of these outlets that, I mean, you have someone like Bryan Danielson that comes along and becomes a big star on a national scale. If you want to go back, these places, I mean, it's not like these are multi-million dollar companies that are making tons of money. They very much survive based on people's curiosity and to dig deeper and watch. So very much go and support them, 100%. That will wrap up this week's show. Did we want to take a look at the feedback thread? I don't know if we had much in the way of actual feedback, but we do have the thread up there.
Yeah, one or two if there's anything interesting.
We were asking for anyone that had a... I mean, there's so many lists of matches up there that I would certainly send people to, whether it be matches in Ring of Honor, PWG. Just scrolling through here, a lot of just different links. I think we'll just leave this up here for people that you can go check on your own leisure. These aren't really in the, not exactly a traditional feedback we've got up there, but a nice collection of matches are up there.
No, you guys don't matter.
My voice is about to die, so we got to wind this one down.
All right, let's talk about what we're going to review next week.
All right, well, Fastlane will be in the books by this time next week, which means we are fully into WrestleMania season, and that is what we are going to be focusing on from now until WrestleMania. The way we are going to structure things this year, we are going to focus on two WrestleManias, and we're going to try and give a more prolonged view of each show. And the
story arcs.
Yes, very much. These are going to be some three-act review-away plays. And we're going to start with WrestleMania 12. So next week, what we're going to do, we're going to review the March 25th, 1996 go-home edition of Monday Night Raw going into WrestleMania that year. And I think it's going to be fun to look at kind of what did a go-home show look like in 1996 for the WWF. When WrestleMania was certainly not anywhere near the beast that it's become now. And we're going to take a look at the 1996 edition of WrestleMania, and we'll look at the Raw going into WrestleMania. We'll review that WrestleMania and then the Raw coming out of it.
The boyhood dream
does come true.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll find that out, as well as the Huckster and Nacho Man culminating in a big free-for-all match at WrestleMania 12.
No, I can't wait to watch
that. So next week, there's a lot for Mr. Ting and I to watch over the next week. So this is a one-hour Raw that I think we'll enjoy.
We want to give our audiences a break, too. Enjoy.
After Super Brawlway, that was the equivalent of like 5 weeks of reviews. So we're going to give us a break here. Mm-hmm. So some extensive WrestleMania 12 coverage coming up over the next few weeks. March 25th, 1996 episode of Raw, and it's up on the WWE Network. Very easy to find. And that's going to wrap things up. You can go to liveaudiowrestling.com for our daily news updates, all of our shows, and all of our video content is up at youtube.com/liveaudiowrestling. You can catch the video versions of Review of Raw, Raw in 3 minutes, as well as past reviews, including the Journey to WrestleMania DVD, which we did last June and kind of encompasses a more full career look at Daniel Bryan and his pre-WWE career, his WWE run, and everything up until WrestleMania of last year. So you can check that out for a even more comprehensive look at Daniel Bryan, as I know you've kind of Bryan'd out.
I think I'm tapped out.
It's been a lot of coverage on Bryan Danielson over the past 10 days. So that will bring everything to a close. Any closing words, Mr. Ting?
No.
Okay, then. All right. Well, good night. We will chat with you later. And thank you for listening to Review Away.
And my NXT rookie is Daniel Bryan. Daniel Bryan is an internet darling. He has traveled the world. Became a star on the minor leagues, on the independents. People say, internet bloggers say that you're great, that you're a star, that you're ready for the WWE. Do you think you're ready?
Yes, I do.